This is the Education Gadfly Show.
Solitary confinement? That's,
yeah, I think that's crazy.
That sounds good. I don't know. All right, maybe not.
Okay.
All right, Daryl.
I don't think you guys know anybody in prison.
Actually.
Hey, you know my last name. I got some cousins.
Now, here's your host, Mike Petrilli.
Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute here at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. And now, please join me welcoming my co-host, the orange is the new black of education reform, Michelle Gininger.
The show is very funny, so I'll take it, though I did not go to Smith. I went to Boston University.
Wait. It's funny? I mean, I've watched a few episodes. It's set in prison. It's not all a bunch of laughs, exactly. I mean, it's also a drama, right?
Well, I think it's both. I think on one hand, it's really funny. On the other hand, there was a post in an op-ed in the Post a few weeks ago saying that this is a very accurate view of what prison is like for women. So I think there's takeaways on both ends, but I enjoy the comedy end of it.
Interesting. We were talking a little bit before the show about some of these shows that have been coming out online. I finally have gotten around to starting to watch House of Cards, and it is amazing, as everybody has said. Although it's influencing the way that I think and write about education. It's making me more cynical again about politics. I guess that's the point, right? Is just to assume that there's all these machinations out there, people working the angles of various issues.
So. It's an excellent show. We'll see if they can keep it going for season two, though.
I do like this whole let's take away federal funding from school districts that have collective bargaining.
The grin on your face.
That's funny. That is funny. This is a problem of actually knowing the topic too well is to know just how unreasonable some of that storyline is. But hey, that's okay. Still fun to watch. Okay, hey, lots to cover. It is back to school time in full force. There's even a chill in the air, at least here in Washington, D.C. Had to bundle up the kids for school this morning. That was kind of fun. And they finally got to wear their new clothes for, you know, they've been wearing their summer clothes. But not today. We're into the fall clothes. It's very exciting.
How is kindergarten going?
Oh my gosh. Nico loves kindergarten. He's already starting to write, which is very exciting. It is inventive spelling, which is okay. For five-year-olds, once they get a little, Pamela's not sold on this, but once they get a little bit older, not so much. But no, he loves it. It's going great. And Leandro's enjoying preschool. The only challenge is that, you know, Leandro goes to the Waldorf preschool and he cannot wear any kind of pictures on his shirt. And so it's a little bit of a fight every morning because Nico gets to wear all kinds of, you know, I don't know, today he had a bear or something on his shirt. Leandro, only stripes. That's all that's allowed.
That's very sad. That's not very creative.
The idea is to not distract the children. Very muted colors.
That's so sad.
No, it's not sad. It's okay. It's okay. It's like they play with wooden toys, not the plastic toys, just wooden. It's all au naturel. It, you know, kind of looks like it could have happened, you know, 150 years ago.
Except for they all have cell phones, right?
No, they do not have cell phones. And by the way, my son has never experienced any education media, okay? If the people from the Waldorf School ask you that, that's the answer, okay? Okay, Pamela, let's get started. Let's play Pardon the Gadfly.
The Ohio Board of Education president is calling for the Toni Morrison novel, The Bluest Eye, to be wiped from the state's Common Core aligned recommended reading list for 11th graders. The book has been a target for Common Core critics nationwide. Are they right?
Michelle?
No, they are not right. I mean, what is next? Salem Witch Trials? I'm sorry. Toni Morrison is a great writer. She's one of my favorite. I have not read The Bluest Eye, but I've read many of her other novels. She's fantastic. She's an inspiration, and 11th grade graders are certainly mature enough to read the content. And yes, some of her stuff is about sore topics, but that is a part of our American history, and we need to embrace that. And I am totally against book banning.
Oh, boom, Michelle, bringing it. Okay, now let me, in defense of the Ohio Board of Education president, she was not calling for the book to be banned, okay? What she says is, look, this is a recommended reading list. And if this is supposed to be a list of exemplar books. And so she was questioning why a book that has this kind of content should be on that list, which is not to say that schools can't teach it if they want to teach it. She just didn't think the state of Ohio should hold it up as an exemplar. Now, I have not read the book either, but I agree that Toni Morrison is a great and important writer, and that our students should be reading Toni Morrison. And as for this scene, I understand it's basically a rape scene, that there's a girl who's abused, right? Again, a painful topic, but you're right, older kids can handle this. What I find most frustrating is that some of the Common Core critics have been throwing around the word pornography, that this is pornographic. I'm like, come on, that upsets me. You know, if dealing with a sensitive issue like rape, this is definitely not pornography. And by the way, Toni Morrison herself is pretty pissed off at the State Board of Education president, because Toni Morrison, by the way, is from Ohio, and this book is set in Ohio.
Good for her for striking back on this. I just think it's her writing is so beautiful, and it's also very, very complicated to follow. So I do think that it is Common Core level. I mean, she is such a beautiful writer, and our students should read our most beautiful writing. And
so the concern too is that if we just take out everything that has any controversy in it, right? You look at all the books that have been banned somewhere over time, right? And what you'd be left with is pablum. And this is why our textbooks and these anthologies and things that kids do read is mostly pablum. Because they're trying not to offend anybody on the right or left.
Well, are we going to ban the Scarlet Letter now? I mean, that is about adultery.
Right.
I mean, that was written.
It was?
Yes.
Oh, right. Yes. I'm just kidding.
Oh, my God.
That's what the A stood for. Right.
I mean, literature has always been about complicated topics, and it's about thinking about these things. And that is what literature class is about.
All right. Topic number two.
The New York Times profiled a teaching strategy called social-emotional learning, which is rooted in the idea that emotional skills are crucial to academic performance. But some argue that it distracts from the importance of knowledge in education. What do you think?
So, you know, this when you read the New York Times Magazine article, I have to say it starts out with a scene that sounded an awful lot like group therapy. Okay, a group therapy with little kids. Tell us how you feel, what happened, let's all talk about our feelings. And look, what I would say is a little bit of this might be appropriate. Certainly, there's going to be issues in the classroom that come up with kids having their, you know, with their own feelings, or there's bullying, or there's whatever getting in the way of learning. Of course, teachers have to address this. Okay, but to go out of their way, carve out time in this very limited school day to do group therapy instead of to teach important content, I think is a disaster. What do you think, Michelle?
I mean, I think obviously we need to be teaching the core subjects, reading, math, science. But at the same time, if parents aren't teaching their kids, if some parents aren't teaching their kids this how to be an emotionally healthy person, then is it the school's obligation to do that? We need to raise smart students, smart adults, and I think emotional whatever is part of this.
You know what? I guess what I would be curious about is I would like to really talk to some educators who are in there running great schools. I certainly think about some of the best charter schools, but also, you know, Catholic schools, also public schools that have a strong culture where they make expectations very clear around behavior and around learning and everything else and around interactions, you know, and they have some kind of school-wide approach to how do you deal with it when kids are mean to each other or are bullying or are having issues, and that they're fine a way to deal and to help build up kids' perseverance and their maturity and their grit and their self-confidence, and all those things are very important. I just don't know if anything that looks like group therapy is necessarily the way to go. And that is my concern. Now, maybe I just have a misunderstanding of what social and emotional learning is, but look, there is this push, including in Montgomery County, where I send my kids to school. Josh Starr, the superintendent, they're big on social emotional learning. And you look at the materials from Montgomery County, and it is held up as an equal objective right next to academic learning. And you say, hold on. School is the only place kids are going to get academics, right? They could get this other stuff from their family, from church, from the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts, from the YMCA, from lots of different places. There's nowhere else where kids are going to learn how to read or how to do science or how to do math.
See, I would disagree. I would say that both inside and outside of school, you should be getting an education, and you should also be learning these skills. So I think we shouldn't make school only the only place you're learning, and outside of school, the only place you're learning how to be an emotionally sound person. I think it's both.
All right.
And if parents can't give their kids this because they're working multiple jobs, or they're not able to do it, or whatever.
Or they're 16.
I think it's our responsibility to make sure that kids are getting this sort of these sort of skills. It's important to be a successful human.
All right. I think I might cry.
See? If you had gotten it.
Yes. I can't cry. I can't let myself. Topic number three.
Another New York Times article explores the potential and drawbacks of the imminent tablet revolution in education. Is this a positive revolution or a disaster in the making?
I've already used the word disaster too many times on the show today, so I'm not going to say a disaster in the making. Michelle, what do you think? This is Joel Klein's Amplify. They got all these tablets out there. Is this going to help?
So I'm torn. On one hand, I think, looking at the professional world, we use so many tablets, we use computers, we use technology, and so we need to teach students how to use these things.
Whoa.
But
we need to teach students how to use these things? Have you? Can I introduce you to my three-year-old? Trust me.
Wait,
we do not need. Oh, right. Don't tell the Waldorf school. Yikes. Busted. Look. Trust me, we do not need to teach little kids how to use these things, okay? That is the crazy. They're so intuitive, they will figure that out. But go ahead. You were saying.
But I'm all for learning how to do math without calculators, learning how to write essays by hand, learning all of this stuff. So I say in the end, no, it's not worth it.
You know, the question here, of course, is how are these tablets going to be used? Now, Amplify, I will say, is partnering with Core Knowledge, right? They are trying to get really solid curriculum out there. And so if this helps to actually get good content out there via in writing, maybe videos as well. I've been doing a feature on our blog about great streaming videos you can get on Netflix or Amazon to teach content, you know, that some of this stuff would work. And especially in a blended learning environment where what it does is it allows the teacher to spend more of his or her time in small groups doing small group instruction. And meanwhile, the kids, instead of crayoning, are actually learning something from the tablets. I mean, all of this can make sense. Of course, the devil's in the details. And it is fair to say that Amanda Ripley does point out in her new book that basically no other countries are as crazy about technology as we are in schools, right? They are not going gaga over online learning or tablets or any of the rest of this stuff. They focus on making sure we got really good teachers who are well-trained and have a solid curriculum and standards, right? That's their strategy in the highest performing countries.
Yeah, I mean, my thing is we can bring tablets when all of our kids are up to speed at performing at the level they should be, and we're far away from that. And so I just think it's putting money where we shouldn't be at this time.
I don't know.
I'm old school.
If you go into a classroom, though, especially in the elementary school, what you will see is there are these literacy groups or these math groups where the teacher is spending some of her time in small groups. And then the question is, what are the other kids doing? And they're at these different stations. And sometimes at the stations, they're crayoning and they're scissoring and they're, you know, which some of that, look, at kindergarten, that's fine. But as they get older, you know, if they were actually learning on a tablet instead, that time might be better spent.
But I don't think the alternatives to tablets is crayoning. I think, you know, these other groups could be doing math problems. They could be doing worksheets. They could be figuring out how to do long division. I mean,
By themselves.
I mean, I think.
Are you saying they should invent algorithms? We do not support that. I just
I just don't think that the alternative to an iPad is crayons.
Yeah. Well, what I'm saying is, in the reality is, I think in many classrooms that is the alternative. So,
well, then maybe we should fix that, not just put tablets in classrooms.
Okay, gotcha. All right, that is all the time we've got for this week's Pardon the Gadfly. Now it's time for everyone's favorite, Amber's Research Minute. Dara, welcome back to the show.
Thanks. Last week was supposed to be my finale, but I'm returning.
Back for one more. Amber is not quite back from her honeymoon. She is coming back, right?
Yes, thank goodness.
All right. Excellent. Hey, by the way, Orange is the New Black. Are you a fan?
I am not, only because I haven't tried it. I tend to binge on Netflix, so I know that once I start, I will not be able to stop. So perhaps
this is a common theme, the binging on
limit.
Netflix.
Plus, I've been binging on football lately, so can only handle one thing at a time.
Michelle, do you think that this show is glamorizing prison? Are we going to see all these women trying to get into prison so that they can enjoy this lifestyle?
No, I don't think so, but there is a storyline in there about someone who sort of voluntarily goes back just because she feels she can't handle the real world. And I think that is something that if you're in prison for a long time and then suddenly you're out of prison with lack of support.
Yeah.
So I think the show, while funny, brings up a lot of good issues.
Yeah. Can imagine it being somewhat relaxing for at first, at least.
I don't know. I mean, she gets starved out. You know, people are trying to kill her. I don't think it's that relaxing.
All right. I guess you're right. Solitary confinement. That sounds good. I don't know. All right, maybe not.
Okay.
All right, Daryl.
I don't think you guys know anybody in prison. For real.
Actually.
Hey, you know my last name. I got some cousins. Anyways, so Dara, what do you have for us this week?
This week, it's a study by J.P. Green, Brian Casita, and Daniel Bowen on the educational value of field trips.
I love this study.
Me too. It is the first large-scale randomized control trial designed to measure what students learn from school tours of an art museum. In 2011, the Crystal Bridges Museum of American Art opened in Arkansas, and because of the high demand for tours, the authors were able to randomly select student groups to go. They matched up participating groups with control groups based on similar grade level and demographics. In total, almost 11,000 students in grades K-12 at 123 schools were involved. About half of those students took a class trip to the art museum. They received only a one-hour tour where they viewed and discussed about five paintings, and depending on time, some could also roam the museum for an hour or two. Several weeks later, the authors gave a quiz to both the participating and control groups. Even after a modest exposure to art, the results were pretty major. First, participating students were able to recall a great deal of factual information from their tour, showing that art can be an important tool to relay content to students. Second, participating students demonstrated a greater ability to think critically about art. The author showed students a painting they had never seen before and asked them to write about it. The participating students did much better. Third, participating students showed greater historical empathy and tolerance than the control group, important concepts not necessarily related to art alone. Finally, participating students were more likely to use a free coupon to bring their families to the museum later on. Hmm. It's important to note that all of these effects, critical thinking, historical empathy, tolerance, and interest in art were much greater for participating students in rural schools, in high poverty schools, minority students, and young students. Advantaged students saw much smaller effects, if any, perhaps because parents already provide culturally enriching experiences. These findings could have large policy implications. Museums across America report a steep drop in school tours because schools are cutting field trips due to lack of funds or increased emphasis on testing, or they're using field trips as rewards for performance rather than enrichment. But this study shows that even a modest exposure to art can have some lasting effects. Mm.
This is so important. You know, first of all, kudos to Jay Green and his team for doing this study, to the folks at Walton, who I'm pretty sure funded it, right? I suspect it's the Walton art people, I mean, as much as the Walton school choice people, right? I mean, this is a really important institution now in Arkansas. I hope this study gets out to a lot of these other art museums around the country who should be using it to promote their tours and other schools. Look, I think this is one of the biggest mistakes that we have made in the education reform movement is to boil everything down to math and reading. And I've been guilty of this. We at Fordham at times have been guilty of this, of saying that, you know, if it doesn't boost student achievement, then it doesn't matter. And that obviously is not a good message to send. There's a lot of other stuff that matters. And, you know, field trips are a great part of the American educational experience.
Something important to note about the way this museum was set up is the endowment actually paid for all of this, including buses, substitute teachers for the students when their primary teacher took them on the field trip. So it's not just a message to the education foundations out there, but also perhaps to the art foundations, mm-hmm. to provide this opportunity to students when the schools can't afford to do it themselves.
Yeah. You know, and this is what's so difficult to figure out is how do we create incentives for schools to do good things, like do a better job teaching math and reading, right, which is important, without creating these disincentives to doing other things that matter too?
Well, I think there's the solution of making these field trips tie into math and reading. I mean, you can go to NASA or at the Air and Space Museum with the Smithsonian, and then you learn something about science and math there. You know, you write an essay about your field trip. I think there are ways to tie it, and I think this is, field trips are imperative.
Right.
Education.
The other thing you have to be sure, though, is to make sure that the other teachers understand the value. I mean, I'm a former classroom teacher in a tested grade, and whenever my students were out, I freaked out because I was losing an entire day of instruction. Mm-hmm. I was losing tutoring time. I was losing homework time. I was losing all of this stuff. But the field trips that they were taking, I did not see as educationally or culturally relevant, because they were often these reward type field trips. You know, we had 100% participation in DC CAS, so let's, you know, go to the water park or something. It was not educationally relevant. And so, you know, I was worried about the negative consequences because I didn't see them as positive experiences for the students.
Well said. And you know, the one thing, Michelle, what was interesting about the study was that they did not look at math and reading test scores, right? They found these other measures, which are, you know, on top of the test scores, and found impacts on those. And look, this is again exciting in that we are seeing some researchers get very creative about coming up with other measures beyond math and reading scores that matter and that can be measured and that can be used to look at student outcomes. And I think that's very healthy. If we can figure out maybe some ways to add those to accountability metrics, then maybe that's something that's worth pursuing.
No, I think that's a great point, that teachers are not held accountable for their students' historical empathy and tolerance.
Right
now, they're held accountable for their math test scores.
Right. And maybe they should be. Okay, thank you. That is all the time we have for this week. We promise Amber will be back next week unless she decides to just kick it in Jamaica for the rest of her life. We don't think that's likely. Find out next week to see how this turns out. Okay, until then.
I'm Michelle Gininger.
And I'm Mike Petrilli at the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.